Life's better with an auto policy from American Family Insurance. No matter what dreams you're driving towards. That's because our expert agents will make you feel totally protected with the right auto coverage at the right price. You'll also save up to 23% when you bundle auto with home. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Zero Books is a critical theory imprint coming out of the UK. Zero Books' most popular title, Capitalist Realism, by the late Mark Fisher, asks why it is that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Other upcoming titles at Zero Books include Angela Nagel's book explaining the causes behind the rise of the alt-right entitled Kill All Normies. Take a look at the Zero Books catalog at zero-books.net.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 136 is something like, how does the entertainment industry affect us? We read The Culture Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception by Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer from 1944, as well as Adorno's 1963 article, Culture Industry Reconsidered. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, complicit in my own helplessness in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, attentive but unimaginative in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Alwyn turning tragedy into the house of moral correction in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, massively deceived in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Beautiful. This seems like a good one to read our ground rules. They include, number one, try not to assume our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say, you'd know what I was talking about if only you'd read Ted Cruz's Hegelian Manifesto, The Bad Kind of Abstraction. And number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining. So this is our second foray into the Frankfurt School. And like our first foray, Eric Fromm recently, we're not really going to talk about the Frankfurt School as a movement, although these guys were the founders, I guess, or among the founders. And this is a little more typical. I mean, they Frankfurt School guys, they mix Marx and Freud, and they have things to say about culture. So that's definitely going on here.
I like that one sentence account of the Frankfurt School.
So
I think Adorno would have made a good dinner guest. Like, hey, this farm-raised chicken is actually just indicates that you're complicit in the factory-raised chickens because in the production of factory production of chickens because it sort of normalizes it or something like that. Anyway, or hey, Dorna, you want to go to see a movie on Friday? Oh, no. Not an easy guy to make plans with.
I'd rather go see a jazz ensemble.
Yeah. Where the involuntary syncopation of the jazz players is a matter of elevating stumbling to a rule.
I love that. But I'm not sure that even a Beethoven... I went to see a Beethoven concert last night. I'm not even sure that would pass muster. Would anything pass muster?
Oh, I think he liked the old... He has a special place in his heart for all authentic culture, which I think includes... Although he's really talking about bourgeois culture as the thing that happened before this. But what is characteristic of bourgeois art is that it's people who were... They didn't have to worry immediately about money. And so they could think about the internal logic of the artwork itself. And yes, that's an illusion. They were only able to do that because they were supported by kings or something like that. And a lot of them did then try to make money off of their things, but he still thought that that was a secondary phenomenon. And what's happened now is that you can't even talk about creation of artwork without talking about how it will be commoditized. That is one of the things he has to say here. Also about how the world is a giant shopping mall and it's a global cultural critique. Any other initial summaries or reactions or before we get into the specifics here?
I agree with Wes. As a cocktail party guest, he would have been exceptionally tedious. But this essay is a quote factory.
Yeah, it's a lot of great.
There's a lot of great tweetable content, ironically.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of great insights as well.
True.
But many of them probably wrong, but
one of my initial reactions was a lot of great observations, but some of it seems anachronistic. Things have changed in mass culture and through technology in ways that seem to address some of the concerns that he has.
Or exacerbate them.
Or exacerbate them. That would be the question.
Yeah, we should argue about that towards the end.
Yeah, that seemed one of the fun things about this. I was hoping from the follow-up Culture Industry Reconsidered that it would be, you know, it's 20 years after the fact that he would be reflecting on how things have changed, but it's more he's just he's just kind of summing up the previous article and responding to some objections that we haven't read, and so didn't seem that, you know,
ultimately, the objection is basically that he's being a snob. That's the objection he's responding to.
Yeah,
and if anything, he digs in on that.
Yeah, snobbery is required because the good and the true are at stake.
But we should put this in context. I know we've just been talking about Adorno. This is from the larger book is Dialectic of Enlightenment. The Culture Industry is a chapter within that book. The book as a whole is written by Horkheimer and Adorno. Horkheimer definitely wrote the first essay. They both claim joint authorship on the whole thing, but normally Adorno is considered the main author of this essay. At least he wrote the first draft. So we'll probably not mention Horkheimer's name anymore. Or we could blame, if there's a uncharacteristic sentence, that we can say, oh, that's probably, that Wiley Horkheimer smuggled that in.
We're just going to make Adorno mean Adorno and or Horkheimer.
Adorkheimer.
Adorkheimer.
I'm sure that joke's never been made.
We would like that we're making, that we're watering down his name and making it more vague in its associations. And
I hope it's been made, because all that this podcast is about is reproducing cultural content. Nothing new coming out of here.
I am genuinely conflicted about whether we are part of the machine or not.
Should we start with what he... So at the beginning, he's sort of responding to an idea that I think was commonly held that we might have concerning the origins of mass culture. And we might think this is just a product of technology and mass production and the way things get kind of sucked up into that. Or maybe even the combination of that with American backwardness and Philistinism. And he rejects that. So he has a more interesting thesis than that bare bones idea.
And he means something by mass culture, something different than popular culture or folk culture.
Yeah. So in that follow-up essay, he said they purposefully chose the culture industry and not mass culture as their operative phrase, because mass culture implies that it's a culture that's sort of the result of the spontaneous wishes of the masses, which sounds a lot like folk culture, when in fact he's going to give an account where it's imposed from the top down. It is an ideology in the service of the powers that be.
I also thought the word industry in particular should bring across the anti-capitalist critique and the capitalist nature of mass culture, both in the United States, but also as a kind of seed of the National Socialists.
Yeah, did you want to talk in terms of a little more about the background of the book? I know you read the intro to it, just as this whole thing came out of that these guys were Germans. They're writing in 1944. They were expats, right? And certainly they're reflecting back on, not that what is going on in America is the same exactly as what happened in pre-war Germany that allowed Hitler to come to power, but that there are... Certainly, that's one of the things that they're afraid of. There are some commonalities, and at the very least, they are trying to present a third way between, if you look at Hitler's Germany as putting forward we need to return to the folk, we need to return to the old ways and reject modernity. And then on the other hand, what the US, what the Western powers were offering, which is rampant capitalism, he's trying to draw on Marx to present a third way.
Yeah, I mean, he's explicitly arguing that it's cultural fascism, and even on around page 125 calls the distinction between business and private life, public life and private life, that turns people into Nazis. He says that. So it's pretty explicit.
He's less explicit about the following, but he clearly has in mind the media propaganda campaigns on the part of the National Socialists and the way they used film and media to engineer public opinion. And he sees it in America. He spends less time worrying about it directly to political ends, but maybe even more insidious ends that nonetheless deprive people of their freedom and make them mere objects of consumer activity. They're merely consumers then, and they lose their freedom as a result of the top-down engineering of the film industry. MGM controls your life. Disney makes you think that you're thinking for yourself, but you're not.
Before we get too far into the text, the subtitle of the essay is Enlightenment as Mass Deception, and it is situated in a book called The Dialectic of Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So I think it might make sense to just kind of tie back to that theme a little bit. The culture industry is a specific manifestation of something that they have a broader view of that I think it might help to just categorize.
Well, maybe one thing to say, since we just covered Hegel, Adorno, in fact, one of his other books is called Negative Dialectics. And I gather that the big shift from Hegel is to say, yes, just like Hegel thought, you could sort of look at one historical period and predict what the next one is going to be, because they're kind of reactions to each other, or he writes a lot. We can tell from here, he's a philosopher of art. He's a philosopher of music. He's a critic. So he talks about how one style in culture will kind of kick off, ready the ground for another style. But what makes it negative, what makes it unlike Hegel, is he doesn't think it's marching forward in progress. He thinks that it's just sort of flailing around based on the logic of the particular stage at hand.
I mean, maybe in the long term, though, there's a synthesis. But in this case, like, the dialectical part is just the sense in which the Enlightenment turns into anti-Enlightenment. This is what he says on page 8 of the other essay we read. So that Enlightenment, which reflects the ascendance of knowledge as this kind of powerful reorganizing thing for human society, turns into a means of mass deception. The technologies that we develop and our scientific progress towards knowledge, ironically, turn into their opposite. They become a means for the opposite. So those are the two antitheses. And I think Marx, at least, would say, ultimately, there's a resolution, right, politically in communism.
And there's some details in here about the Enlightenment view of individualism, how there's something contradictory about that, and you could see how that would break down. And there's other individual points about what you might consider the Enlightenment, you know, in terms of the rise of the individual rights and the scientific method and all that.
But just, you know, bringing it back to the beginning, the other thing that I thought was interesting, his argument against the idea that mass culture is just a form of technology-induced chaos, is the idea of sameness, the making of things identical as a feature of mass culture. So this is just in the first few pages.
Yeah, in particular by equating the whole of things with the parts, so that every whole is merely the sum of the parts, and so therefore there's no distinction between any whole and parts. There's nothing to be gained by things coming together. And so you just get kind of a proliferation of a big heap of things.
I just went back and I read the intro or the first part of the book just enough to try to get some context. And in those first few pages of the book, he talks about how the program of enlightenment was the disenchantment of the world, which is to say that knowledge meant power over nature. And knowledge is truly emergent. It's limitless and it has no maker. So it's not something you can design. It's something that just proliferates. And technology was the essence of this kind of knowledge. And that what human beings sought to learn from nature was how to dominate it. And in turn, how to dominate human beings. And so in his mind, the Enlightenment project, Enlightenment is totalitarianism. The Enlightenment project is about total domination through knowledge and technology. And one of the elements that gets you to the point of sameness is the idea that a project like this requires unity. There can't be anything outside of the system. So the idea that human behavior of all sort could be embodied in a science, which could then be subsumed into a broader rubric of science, this notion we have of trying to connect all of the various physical sciences. You know, you're looking for that unifying theory, which explains how gravity and all these other things fit together, is symptomatic of this limitless knowledge that just seeks to bring everything under its control. There can't be anything outside of the system of knowledge. And in that sense, that's how it pushes, when we get to talking about the culture industry, the requirement for sameness. You can't be different. There can't be any individuals that lie outside of the system. If there's anything outside, it has to be appropriated and subsumed underneath some kind of rubric.
Yeah, so on page 94, he starts with all these examples of what you might think of as cultural variety, right? So different types of buildings, the more monumental buildings or buildings that are kind of more utilitarian in structure. And he's going to argue that they are essentially the same in the sense that they serve the same overarching political purpose, which is to subjugate individual autonomy to capital. So that's where the sameness comes from, I think. Even though you might, aesthetically, you might think there are all these different cultural manifestations, it's the overarching purpose which stamps them with sameness.
Which I think this, right off the bat, we're getting an example of this thing that we're going to see throughout, is when you say they serve an overarching purpose, like, well, whose purpose is that? Or what kind of explanation are we giving by saying right. this is the purpose of it? That's, I don't want to try to answer that now, but we can't avoid that question that long.
Right.
He talks in on page 99 a little more about the culture industry putting an end to the distinctions. And he gives this image of a filing cabinet that creates order, but not connections. Lacking both contrast and relatedness, the whole and the detail look alike. Their harmony guaranteed in advance mocks the painfully achieved harmony of the great bourgeois works of art. In Germany, even the most carefree films of democracy were overhung already by the graveyard stillness of dictatorship. So there he's clearly pointing to propaganda-type films where you would be portraying a democratic-type freedom, which was already just squeezed out of the situation.
Yeah, and in that place in particular, he's talking about the sense in which art used to be focused, for instance, on subject matter, on a certain detail.
Internal logic.
Yeah, and at the expense of the harmonic effect of the form as a whole. So the detail of the painting was more important than the overall composition, and a novel's plot structure was less important than, for instance, psychological penetration and so on. But the culture industry reverses that. It makes it more top-down. And so the parts are sort of subjected to what he calls the formula, which reminded me of De Anima a little bit. So it's this kind of malignant soul that determines the cultural product.
Well, and in keeping with this dialectical take on the advance of art, even what you're saying, it's not just the bad thing that culture industry offers us and the good thing that was around before. It was in particular that detail where the focusing on the element outshone the focusing on the whole. That was something that came with expressionism and
romanticism.
Right. Yeah. So if folks go back to our Kant on aesthetics episode, that's sort of the starting point for enlightenment. Enlightenment obviously encompassed a number of years.
Well, romanticism rebels against the Enlightenment.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But they're both, right. Okay, I guess we haven't had one specifically on romanticism. I thought as far as Adorno and Horkheimer were concerned, they're sort of part and parcel of modernity. Let's just say that. Modernity encompasses the Enlightenment and romanticism. And now with this kind of critique, we are trying to get us toward post-modernity.
Yeah, I think they lump romanticism in with everything else.
As the before.
Yeah, modernity starts around 1600, technically. So we're safe to lump those all into modernity.
So Kant is all about, beauty is about form. And when Adorno is looking back in here at what was cool about things before the present age, it's because of the focus on form taken in its deepest sense, the internal logic of the work, that just as there's a dialectic between spurring one idea to another, one historical period to another, there is an internal logic that is dialectical in the same way, I would think, where one part of a work of art is going to entail certain other things about it. And so making a well-developed character or anything else like that is going to require obeying some not written rules. In fact, they can't be written. That was kind of a big thing that from Kant to Santayana was emphasized, that these rules are all post hoc. That's kind of what makes a piece of art wonderful and individual, is that it's only when the creator is actually in there rooting around things. You can't just apply a formula and figure out what the rest of the details are going to be.
But it's accessible to you. It gets revealed by you interacting with it. At the beginning of that section, page 98, he points to the Kantian schematism was a good thing, and the active contribution with which Kantian schematism still expected of its subjects is denied to the subject by industry. It purveys schematism as its first service to the customer.
Yeah, he calls it the schematism of production. So we have this really interesting idea that a Kantian cognitive category is actually being replaced with this cultural category that does this work.
And that's the way in which you lose all your freedom.
Yep. Right? Yep. You're not thinking with your own mind. You're thinking with the hive mind.
Yeah. And to me, that understanding sort of made clear the tone of the paper. I mean, if you really feel like mass culture, the culture industry is lobotomizing the entire populace and turning them into slaves, it'd be like the same kind of reaction you'd have to everybody becoming plugged into the Matrix or something like that, right? If it was actually happening, that kind of sense of appalling indignation at the ebbing enslavement of everybody.
All right, so I like how Dylan jumped ahead to get us to the work of art and what's wrong with works of art today. Because otherwise, the stuff earlier in the paper, I think just if you lead off with it, like Adorno did here, it sounds crazy.
I agree. Yeah, I think this is like the first meaty section to discuss the, yeah, and especially style. So,
but let's get some of this crazier stuff out of there. And that page 95, technical rationality today is the rationality of domination.
Oh, I thought you were advocating...
He wants to go back and get it out of the way.
I want to at least get this on the table. And I think maybe then Seth will talk some more because he probably had notes from the beginning and was irritated that we skipped to them.
That's all right.
What else do you want to say about the beginning, Seth?
I want to make the point that he wants to talk about the culture industry versus mass culture because he wants to avoid the idea that culture somehow emerges from people themselves. Mass culture suggests that the desire or what is being produced is somehow what people want. And he is adamant about the fact that he uses the term culture industry because it's a top-down thing. The content or the objects of culture are produced by the industry for consumption by people regardless of what their desires are.
It shapes their desires, right?
So. It shapes their desires. The point is, it's an imposition.
It's not like I have all these preferences and then society is, you know, trying to meet my demands. It induces those demands in me. This idea that I have this freedom in my consumption is an illusion.
Right. Culture is not an art. Industrial culture is not art. It's a business. And it leverages technology in the same way that he was talking about early on about technology being the essence of this enlightenment knowledge. Technology is at play in the manufacture of culture as well. And in the same sense, it works hand in hand with the form of enlightenment knowledge to dominate the consumer.
Especially the way you were describing it, it reminded me how much I thought of Plato's cave, but in Adorno and Horkheimer's interpretation, that the culture industry is a kind of a cave of that sort. I don't want to call it a Platonic cave, but a cave in which people are looking at the world in a very restricted manner and don't realize actually that they're looking at the world in such a restricted manner that is being in fact engineered by somebody. So rather than them, you know, rather than asking the question, who chained you into the cave that Plato doesn't ask, and that you just free yourself, in this case, it's MGM Studios that's chained you in the cave.
It's worth mentioning here that the technology he's speaking of is mass broadcast technology, for example, like radio, because that was a relatively new invention in that time that was effectively used by Hitler and, of course, also by Churchill and by Franklin Roosevelt, that it was basically a way for somebody who was a central authority or a central power to disseminate a message to the masses, but to do so in a way where there was no possibility of reply. That when you're at a rally or when you're meeting somebody face to face or even when you're talking with them over the telephone, there's the possibility of a response and interaction. But when you're sitting in front of a radio, you become a passive listener. And this is all part of the experience of being dominated, that your subjectivity gets taken away.
Yeah. And the nuance to that is that it's not just that technology sort of rises willy-nilly to dominate, right? So he's making the argument that the culture industry is not simply the effect of technology rising to meet people's needs. And when he says technical rationality is the rationality of domination, it's the domination that comes first. It's the technology simply serves this impetus towards domination. It serves the powers that be within a society. And then the other thing I thought of was when Dylan mentioned the cave, the schema through which everything is filtered, he calls, quote unquote, the logic of work. So that's sort of the central concept that's going to distort the products of the culture industry. That's what it's imprinting on things.
Yeah. This little section I think is worth quoting. So I'm going to read just a couple of sentences. technical rationality today is the rationality of domination. It is the compulsive character of a society alienated from itself. Automobiles, bombs, and films hold the totality together until their leveling element demonstrates its power against the very system of injustice it served. For the present, the technology of the culture industry confines itself to standardization and mass production and sacrifices what once distinguished the logic of the work from that of society. These adverse effects, however, should not be attributed to the internal laws of technology itself, but to its function within the economy today. So that's just to your point that ultimately he's tying this back in, that the function these are playing inside the system is not driven by the systems, but rather driven by capital.
Right. So this is not a Heideggerian critique right. of technology, even though some of the things he says nope. do sound a little like that through here. But it is a Marxist critique of just this is where capitalist society is at now. And by saying
yep.
the technical rationality is really just about practical reason. Technology enables us to get things done. So whatever it is that the people in power want to get done, rationality, these technical tools, which don't even have to just be the radio. It could just be organizational methods. It could be the fact that we are mm-hmm. having certain hiring practices and things like that, that
we have a 40-hour work week or a 50-hour work week.
Yeah, that all these things that make things uniform, make people easier to control.
Make them into commodities, make them into consumers and workers.
One of the points he has to argue here is that being a consumer is the flip side of being a worker. They are one and the same thing. It's not just that we need you to work and we need to make money by selling our products. Is that the products are designed to make you, at least the cultural products are designed to make you into a better worker.
Yeah, the consumption is just the logic of work imprinted on leisure time.
We go to the mall after we're done working. And the movies.
Right. The kind of thing that we enjoy is the kind of thing that, like, the only purpose for, I think he says, is it's for people who are tired of work and need to get some break so that they can go back and work again.
So it doesn't make too many demands on
it makes
you no demand. Mentally. Yeah.
It's a skill to, like, pay attention, like, to follow what's going on in a movie. Like, I remember showing my kids movies that seemed pretty basic, but just to follow, like, well, wait, who's that guy? Who, like, there's things that you have to pay attention to. And I think in the movies of his time, it was probably considerably more subtle. Like, I think it's a little harder sometimes to follow older movies than today's movies where everything is telegraphed so far in advance. Although I think a lot of the kind of things he's complaining about movies, like, you know, he doesn't say this, but like music that tells you what to feel, but that's like entirely in keeping with the kind of complaint he has here.
Yeah. Well, I think when he was writing, he didn't probably have a huge section on film noir, but there's probably a whole second podcast to be done just on the references that he drops to try to figure out like why Greta Garbo is on the border of possibly actually being interesting and authentic and subtle.
And Benny Goodman is not either.
But Mickey Rooney is.
Yeah, he hates Mickey Rooney. But he calls Orson Welles, like, doesn't he call him a criminal or something? Like, by the way, he mentions Greer Garson, who was a great actress. Her husband's on the board of trustees for St. John's Santa Fe, and she was a huge supporter of St. John's. So I just wanted to mention that since he directly calls her out as well. So
the crass modern way of reading this, you know, if you just do a surface level reading, isn't low culture bad? Isn't all these yeah. movies for stupid people? But he's very adamant that it's the entire culture industry. It's not, in fact, one of the things that it removes is the distinction between low and high culture. So that not only, you know, are high cultural products expected to be marketable and are evaluated in marketing terms, but low culture is expected to be really not as stupid in some ways as it was. It can't be pure amusement. It has to.
Yeah, it's intellectualized.
Yes, yes. So that it's not even as enjoyable as a circus would be. It's not circuses. That would be embarrassing, amateurish, that everything gets professionalized.
Yeah, that's on page 114, by the way, if you want to look at that. The intellectualization part becomes the, you know, everything is experienced as facsimile. And you sort of, you know, you're mentioning circuses, you sort of take the naivete out of low culture. Low culture by itself has positive things to it, but it's turned into what he calls, quote unquote, trash in its fusion with high culture.
Even the supposed people who are into high culture, they just get pegged as one more demographic group to be aimed at. Even though there's an emphasis throughout here on how the culture industry promotes sameness, there's still sort of different levels. There's a recognition that some people are richer than others, or some people have more education than others, that there are different social classes, and that's not what is crushed down. They're not equalized by all means, but it becomes a matter of, oh, well, you can afford the 4-cylinder car and you just get the 2-cylinder car, or these movies are A-list movies and they have all these stars. They're sort of aimed at a different crowd than the B-list wrestling pictures or whatever with fewer stars. Even supposedly revolutionary elements, like it's okay to be a hipster as long as you're conforming as a hipster. Capitalism is very happy to aim its hipster line of clothes or whatever at you.
Eventually, we need to talk about whether this kind of power is any different than the kinds of power that were before, because that's central to his criticism. Is it really the case that MGM is different than other forms of political power or economic power that have existed before? I mean, his answer is yes, and the pervasiveness, at the very least in degree, is such that it changes it qualitatively. Its quantitative difference makes it qualitatively different, and that the presence of technology in that way is a new thing.
I mean, he explicitly addresses at one point that, yeah, okay, in the days of monarchy, it was, if you don't obey me, I will kill you. Now it's more, if you don't obey the trend, then you're economically out in the cold, then you're marginalized and you're a loser. And so that's what keeps us in the cave, is because we don't want to be losers. We don't want to be marginalized. We want to not starve. That's what the freedom has been. It was the freedom of the stupid to starve. There's a quote like that somewhere in here.
Page 105. And it basically, it's social coercion replaces the coercion of the state.
Yeah. When I remember reading that section, and I was immediately brought to mind of Foucault, but he is suggesting that this gets internalized, right?
Yeah.
In the same way that Foucault was talking about the internalization of the external strictures so that we sort of self-regulate. But the difference here is that there's this enormous machinery in place to constantly reinforce.
While there is something top-down about it and something sort of conspiratorial about it, it's not quite the same thing as a monarch sitting above and saying, you're going to do X, Y, and Z. It's more that those who have power in the culture industry, they maintain their power by viewing everyone as consumers, and everything is replaceable, and every worker as fungible. And that activity itself is what's corrupting. It's what leads to its own natural activity to just give you what you think you want, because I'm going to make every person their own demographic and I'm going to make them feel like they're choosing what they want to choose. But really, what I ultimately want to do is make sure I manipulate them into choosing what I want them to choose. It's basically power by PR and advertising.
Yeah, so it is to a large degree, I think, intentional, I think he thinks. And he says that in the extra essay that we had. It intentionally integrates consumers from above.
Well, at one point he talks about it's either the actual cooperation of the people on top, or at least it's the common determination that they're both driven by the same economic logic. So it's not necessarily that there's a cabal of executives, but it's just they're driven by the same thing. And another place, page 98, although the operations of the mechanism appear to be planned by those who supply the data, the culture industry, the planning is in fact imposed on the industry by the inertia of a society irrational despite all its rationalization. And this calamitous tendency in passing through the agencies of business takes on the shrewd intentionality peculiar to them. So that makes it sound like it's very high-level Marxist. Yes, okay, it's the evil people in power that are doing this, but it's also the irrationality of the society as a whole. It's where it's shifted given the structures that we have in place.
So hence you can have a company say, look, I'm just selling the stuff that people want. Look, they're buying it like crazy.
Yeah, I think the word inertia is important. There's a status quo that forms, and you stop asking why, you stop asking about the meaning of it or whether it's wise, and it just runs its course. It keeps going. That's the irrational part. The rational thing to do would be think about it and change it.
This is the first essay in philosophy that I've ever read that has the word satanically in it.
That was one of the sections in the copy that I had that had been highlighted prior to the scan. So I couldn't tell. It was like, I read that and I thought, is that? That must be another word. It can't, but I couldn't think of what it could possibly be. So,
or that says things like, to impress the omnipotence of capital on the hearts of expropriated job candidates as the power of their true master is the purpose of all films. How about that?
Okay. Well, so this is talking about the inertia and irrationality versus the cabal on the other side, the intentional deception. I think that gets at, what does it mean is it's the purpose of all films. It says it's the purpose of all films, despite what plot the production designer may have selected.
Right.
So of course, individual producers of artworks of films, even in the studio system, you know, they have things that they want to say. There's different morals in the different plots that they pick, but Adorno just thinks that that's all subservient to the overall social function of what the thing is.
Well, he does think, though, that the focus on the technical, so this idea of impressing the omnipotence of capital, it's the idea of the impressiveness of the technical. And there's that focus in the same page, 98, he's talking about the focus on the technical as opposed to the content, the sensuous elements of a film.
Okay. I read that section as slightly differently. And this goes back to what you mentioned earlier, Wes, about making the product, making it consumable. So he says on page 98, even during their leisure time, consumers must orient themselves according to the unity of production. The active contribution which Kantian schematism still expected of subjects, that they should, from the first, relate sensuous multiplicity to fundamental concepts, is denied to the subject by industry. It purveys schematism as its first service to the customer. So even if I think I'm making a work of art as a director or producer or writer, I'm still following some kind of a narrative structure that's going to have an arc that's going to reinforce the messages of the society, which has produced me as well. It's not just the laborers, but I'm part of that machinery of production. And he speaks later in the essay about how the industry is constantly craving clever people to come in who are able to translate that experience of being part of the framework of production into culture, which can then be consumed by workers and reinforce that message of production. And it starts with making sure that from the outset, there's a villain, there's a hero, there's a heroine, there's a love interest. All of these things are given to you by the movie. You're not challenged.
Right. And you know how it's going to end as soon as it starts.
Yeah. And so as a producer, I just need to be clever enough to make it interesting so that you stay watching it, even though all these things are already known.
Yeah. And the message, which we'll get to later, but it's basically that life sucks, but it can't be changed. And so you can have these substitute gratifications, but you can't have anything else. That's going to be the overarching message of any culture industry work of art.
Yeah. He does talk a lot about how, like, you can't have an inappropriate relationship that goes unpunished is one of the examples he gives from his time. But he also says on page 97, looking for where he talks about it being Jewish. Okay, yeah, the context is he's talking about how the culture industry is subservient to Chrysler and to the energy companies, to the banks. The culture industry leaders have to keep with the true wielders of power to ensure that their sphere of mass society, the specific product of which still has too much of cozy liberalism and Jewish intellectualism about it, is not subjected to a series of purges. So that the most powerful broadcasting companies are still dependent on electrical industry, the film on banks, et cetera, et cetera. They're all economically intertwined. So there could be, again, I think specific messages in specific films that are not overtly in line with the whole. That goes sort of hand in hand with rebelliousness is tolerated so long as it has limits, so long as it can be controlled and co-opted. In fact, that could be the hipster movie, could be aimed at you. You're such a rebel that the corporation has a product for you too.
Right. The place, Mark, where you talked about sexual transgression must result in punishment, he's also saying that you can have a film that inveighs against capitalism. That's permitted.
In fact, it's encouraged.
Right. And the idea that sexual transgression must be punished is not Puritanism, but it's basically the idea that, so Free says, quote unquote, page 113, not for a moment allowing him or her to suspect that resistance is possible. It's really the larger significance that you can't defeat the system. That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He said, even if you're inveighing against capitalism, that idea that resistance is futile can still be the message of the film, ultimately.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, if you think about how many movies are there where the quirky outsider, right? All these teen movies where there's the straight-laced kids, and then there's the John Cusack, right? Or, sorry, that dates me.
It dates you with everybody else in this conversation.
Somehow there's the one who's supposed to not fit or has the quirky point of view or does something or wears the weird clothes or whatever, ultimately has to get appropriated back into the system so that it's understood that even if it's that they in turn are able to convince all of the straight-laced people to adopt some of their weird ways, the point is there's some form of conformity and sameness that comes in. it's not the case that the loner gets shunned and there's no relationship ever formed and that they end up walking alone into the sunset or whatever. The narrative always has to be that you can't fight the system. And it's couched in one way or another.
Yeah, their victory is always their incorporation into the system.
Yes.
That is their...
Exactly. And with the veneer that they've won, right? But I would expect that Adorno and Horkheimer would say that it only appears that they won. That's the whole point of it, that they actually have become part of the system in exactly the way everyone expected, that the appearance of freedom when actually they were just brought back into the Borg.
Well, I would think that a lot of this has to do with the way he presents it. Usually the people that are in trouble get saved by some member of the establishment. It's a helpful police officer or something. Something he's reflecting on what, I don't know, the crime films of his time. It's much more common now for the government to be portrayed as the incompetent enemy. We had David Brin on here who talked about this as, yeah, the two things that are common in all modern films are that the main character has to be quirky and eccentric in some way. That's very strange that that's a new thing. And that the government people are never helpful. You never want to call the police, no matter how logical in a real life situation would be to call the damn police. No, we have to take it on ourselves. I have to rescue E.T. by myself or whatever. I think the overall point, even though the current situation is different from the film industry as Adorno is describing it, still, it's the fact that we spectators, it's a, oh, we're triumphing over the system. But that feeling, the feeling is illusory. It's the fact that, no. It's just a little fantasy that was put forward. The system is actually just as strong as ever. And it's just, you feel like you've rebelled against it by sympathizing with these rebellious characters. And that serves to calm you down. It doesn't serve to make you.
You're consuming a fantasy of rebellion, a substitute gratification.
Exactly.
You're not actually rebelling. Yeah. Lots of products, lots of advertising campaigns are structured around that very idea that they're somehow rebellious to.
If you get a Casper mattress, you're rebelling against the establishment.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to establish your identity, right? Mm-hmm. You, by rebelling, you are declaring yourself unique and an individual and therefore asserting your freedom. And to the extent that a advertising company can make you feel like an individual, then you're going to feel all the more likely to buy their product because it makes you feel like you are your own person. I mean, that's the funny trick about it, right? Is you don't want people necessarily to feel simply like they're doing everything everybody else is doing, even though getting on the bandwagon is part of a lot of advertising. You need to make the customer feel like they are not risking so much and being ostracized, but they're also defining themselves and articulating their own individuality and freedom, but by wearing your lipstick.
So they don't actually choose Charles Manson as their spokesperson, because then you'd be a real rebel to use it.
Right. The countercultural protagonist in a film is never that, you know, Mark, you mentioned the loser, or he talks about the loner. It's never the real outcast and societal loner. Mm-hmm. It would never go to the extreme where you couldn't actually identify with them. And they have to be safe to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Although it's interesting to see, you know, how influential this essay was and how I think this could be seen as, you know, whether it's a direct influence or people or this got into the culture enough so that I feel like there are plenty of sort of indie movies that were created almost specifically to break the rules here.
Well, yeah, you look at Natural Born Killers, you look at a lot of the entertainment where sociopaths are the protagonists.
I do think that you have to think about what movies were like and even the structure of the movie and recording industry in the 30s and 40s. It was very different than it is now. While there are some things in this essay that really, I think, continue to resonate, it's not at all clear that, again, the criticism isn't somehow a product of a certain period of time in the technological development and distribution of television, radio, and movies. It used to be that if you were an actor, you belonged to a studio. You didn't get hired by them. You belonged to them the way you belonged to a basketball team. You could get just traded around. You acted in whatever they told you to act in. It's different than that now. And there's just also, there are lots of big movie companies and, you know, they certainly have tons of influence, but there's just enormous numbers of other ways of getting movies made.
So have you guys seen Zizek's Pervert's Guide to Cinema?
Mm-mm.
That's maybe a coda to this episode to encourage people to go take a look at that. It's kind of a crazy, wacky little roller coaster of a ride. Zizek basically is applying the critique of the culture industry to films specifically talking about how they function to reinforce social norms and all these sorts of things. And it's really fascinating, I have to say. And it's entertaining. It's quite entertaining. And you should take a look at it. And there's an argument to be made that the suggestions that he's making about how the content plays out, even though he had specific models in mind talking about the studio system, he would not have seen film noir. There's a bunch of things he would not have seen still are at play and can still be read into these films as text in that way. Although I do think there was probably some divergence of cinema, particularly in like the 70s, where maybe people started recognizing that that was the role it was playing in and deliberately contravening those assumptions. But we seem to be back on it.
In a way, the content isn't really the thing, doesn't matter for him. I mean, in fact, it's one of the features of the culture industry that the content isn't really the point. So this is kind of page 98 into 99. One of his complaints is that there's all these cliches and stereotypes which serve the larger purpose of what he calls the schematism of production. Again, it's the things like resistance is futile, you know, enforcement of the status quo, things like that. And then he says, quote unquote, the details become interchangeable. So there's less focus on content and more focus on technique, more focus on the technology that's producing this. You know, you see in contemporary films are very, very well made technically, usually from every angle, from plot structure to acting to all the kinds of ingredients you would want out of a great film. But that doesn't save it for Adorno from being what it is, which is this enforcement of the status quo.
I kind of had a question about like the way he was viewing film. And the bottom last paragraph of 99, he says the whole world is passed through the filter of the culture industry. And the familiar experience of the moviegoer who perceives the street outside as the continuation of the film he has just left, because the film seeks strictly to reproduce the world of everyday perception, has become the guideline for production. Going on, since the abrupt introduction of the sound film, mechanical duplication has become entirely subservient to this objective. According to this tendency, life is to be made indistinguishable from the sound film. Far more strongly than the theater of illusion, film denies its audience any dimension in which they might roam freely in imagination, contained by the film's framework but unsupervised by its precise actualities. Without losing the thread, thus, it trains those exposed to it to identify film directly with reality. Certainly now, if you were to watch a movie from 1936, there's nothing about that that you would confuse with reality, right? There's not a single thing about it. And furthermore, the idea that you would walk out of the movie theater and say, what I've seen on the movie is what I'm seeing in real life, I just find it going a step too far about it. And then to say that that trains those exposed to identify film directly with reality, it made me also wonder, is it really the case that there was no such thing as irony in a film at all that moviegoers would identify with? Who knows? Maybe it's true.
I want to defend old films here. There are a lot of great old films. And Orson Welles is not the hack that Adorno thinks he is, yeah.
The claim is that you wouldn't confuse them with reality.
Yeah. So to defend their position here in this, I think what he's trying to say is that they're not fantastical. The films he's talking about are the ones that have recognizable everyday characters that you can relate to. It's one of the criteria if the film is going to play the role of amusing you and distracting you from the realities of your mechanized labor long enough so that you can go back and get back at it again. It could do that by providing a flight of fancy where you would just be completely taken away in some kind of a, what do they used to call it? Buxter Berkeley musical or some sort of fantasy, but that without the intellectualized version of that, you would eventually become bored. So what he's trying to say is that the movies have to create characters that you can identify with to the extent that you can see in the film an extension of reality as you're experiencing it. And then they're going to tell that tale in that context, even if it is a structure that's superimposed on a fantastical or, say, science fiction-y kind of setting.
I also think he's just thinking about the medium of film here and its difference from other types of representation. It's verisimilitude. And we should be thinking here of Kant and Schopenhauer, where the aesthetic for Kant, right, required this free play of the imagination. It required that something be left to the imagination, which means it required that whatever the mimetic function of art, it be imprecise. And I forget if you guys read this part of Schopenhauer as well, but Schopenhauer talks about the aesthetic failure of a mannequin or anything that's too realistic. If it gets too realistic, it fails to be aesthetic. And the flip side of the aesthetic is what Kant called the charms, right? That's the plot. That's all the explosions. And that's the stuff that interests us. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that films are on the side of the charms and the interest, and they're less aesthetic. And to say they're less aesthetic, it sort of coincides with the medium of film, which is, it's a very accurate visual picture of the world.
But it becomes a criticism that's just like the Platonic criticism of poetry, right? Or the Socratic criticism of writing, where you have, on the one hand, the criticism of poetry as being merely for entertainment or cookery and not for the good or the truth. And you have the Socratic criticism of writing as purging us from having to think about things and becoming sophistry. It seems like both of those things are going there. And then even to the extent that there's something about the criticism that's true, which may be there, it comes across as just another version of old man whininess about the changes of the world before him. And it's not like the way he used to be.
It is. I mean, the whole thing is like that.
This is a giant extended, "You kids get off my lawn."
There's a big part of it that feels that way.
Well, I'm still sympathetically, I'm trying to give some defense of the piece that Dylan was objecting to, which is not just that, okay, sound films are trying to duplicate the world, but that the point of it, however far it might fall from our present standards from the mark, I mean, even just think about more modern films. Does it make it so that you then walk out of the theater and feel like the world is like what you just saw? And I've certainly felt that with some films, especially weird films. Like, I walk out and I just like, wow, that was disorienting. The whole world just looks different to me. What he's talking about very specifically is ones where I think where the characters, like you're saying, they're supposed to be ones you can identify with, where the situations are supposed to be realistic in some way. And so you might then feel like the world is going to be just in the way that things are in the films, that people are going to fit stereotypes in the way that they do in films, that kind of stuff.
But he's not really talking about your expectations, though. He talks about movies as the duplication of empirical objects and the making of life and it being indistinguishable from life.
But that isn't that the source of the rhetorical power along the lines of what Mark is saying? That is that indistinguishability, which gives it the veneer of truthfulness.
So,
but
yeah,
what it's actually saying is not. That's the mechanism which with it robs you your freedom. I mean, that's sort of the argument.
Yeah. The robbery of the freedom is again, back to Kant, the aesthetic is supposed to be, it's an act of freedom. It's the free play of the imagination. It's the correlate of the moral, the freedom that you get in the moral realm, that kind of autonomy. There's aesthetic autonomy, which means being able to do something spontaneous with your imagination in response to a work of art. So that's one part of the autonomy. And the realism deprives you of that. And I really think he's not really talking about the realism of plot, although maybe he is, but I really think he's thinking about sound, the visual and auditory components of this. I think he's thinking about the medium primarily here. And the point of it is that the more realistic it is, the more robbed of the autonomy, the autonomous buzzing of the imagination you are.
All right. So that's how it affects when you leave the theater, the sort of thinking that is required for watching a movie, which is to pay attention
right
to what's going on, that's the way you're going to be when you go out. And that's what would make you a good worker and not filling in the blanks of imagination.
Yes. We don't want any workers filling in any blanks.
And you could add in, you know, modern critiques to that, just like, well, it's so unrealistic in the movies that there's always music behind them. But now we walk around with our portable music devices and we create that soundtrack to make our lives even more like movies.
I know. I couldn't get through a day if I didn't have my own soundtrack.
But I just use a sinister theme, you know, just like in the old time movies and the villain comes on and the sinister theme plays. So I just play a sinister theme for myself on my iPod all the time. Because that's how I see myself.
I don't listen to anything. In fact, I've gotten so that I don't even like listening to music when I'm doing the dishes or anything.
Really? Yeah. Why?
It's a combination of things. It's one is I find that if I'm thinking about something, I don't want to be listening to something, listening to music.
Oh, you just giving your imagination free play, giving your ability to think. No, join us. Join us. Blot it all out. Make it like a movie.
Well, I find myself listening to podcasts, which makes it impossible to think about. That's good. Like if you're going for a walk, you know, I would think about stuff, but in general, yeah, now I'm consuming some.
Pause. Yeah. You can pause. It's not like the radio. You can pause it.
I do. I do pause.
Yeah.
All right. That seems like a good place to stop.
Pause.
To pause. And everybody should come back next week and hear the second half of this discussion.
Or get the whole thing now.
You could rebel. Don't just go along and take what iTunes feeds you. Break out of that. If you pay us, sign up for a partially examined life citizenship for a mere $5, then you get a different feed targeted at you, the rebel.
You can satisfy our intention.
Right, and hear this all at once. So, because if you just listen to the second half on your own later, you'll be all fresh. But we're already giddy when we start the second half. So you want to be in that mood. Or else you could just drink a lot before you do the second half.
Yeah, we're either giddy or drunk.
So. In any case, farewell until then.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.